Second case today is United States v. Hernandez. This is a certified case, which means the United States is the appellant. Is the United States prepared to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And Hernandez?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. United States may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Mary Ellen Payne, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Matt Neal, we represent the United States in this case. MRE 311 D4B and the Supreme Court's decision in Franks v. Delaware give an accused a very specific, limited way to challenge the veracity of a search authorization. There must be allegations of deliberate falsehood or reckless disregard for the truth. The accused must request a hearing. Before getting that hearing, the accused must make a substantial preliminary showing of recklessness or deliberate falsehood. And at that hearing, if granted, the accused has a further burden to prove recklessness by preponderance of the evidence. Appellee did not do any of these things here. In fact, Appellee's defense counsel said that she was not accusing the officer who drafted the affidavit of any improper conduct. Now, despite Appellee's failure to follow MRE 311 and the absence of any Franks hearing to allow the government to rebut any claims of recklessness, the Air Force Court incorrectly overturned the Appellee's case on the basis of a reckless affidavit. Since Appellee failed to follow MRE 311 and disclaimed any improper conduct by law enforcement, this court should find the allegation of a false or reckless affidavit to be waived and should reverse the CCA's decision. Now, then again, there are also three other reasons why this court should reverse the CCA's decision.
Before you move on, if I may, Ms. Payne, ask you a question. So during the suppression hearing, the military judge excised the statement.
Correct.
What authority did the military judge have to do that?
Well, Your Honor, I do not believe that he actually had any authority to do that under MRE 311 or Franks. He relied on United States versus Gallo, but I think what's important to remember about Gallo is that wasn't actually a case about a false statement. It was about information that had been gathered based on potentially an Article 31 violation. And so that was really different. And so what this court seemed to have done in Calgill is sort of conflate the two and say that it also, this excising the statement would also apply potentially in a Frank situation. But Calgill, this court did recognize that there was tension between what Gallo was suggesting and Frank's, but they said they didn't need to decide the issue in this case because one way or the other, the conduct was reckless.
But it's the government's position that even in the course of a Frank's hearing, a military judge does not have the authority to excise a statement?
Unless it is first determined that the statement was deliberately false or reckless. Until you first get to the threshold of meeting the substantial preliminary burden where you can even have a Franks hearing, and then at the Franks hearing, then there must be a showing by preponderance of the evidence. And only then may the military judge excise any of those statements or, in the case of an omission, add them in and then evaluate probable cause at that standpoint. But that is definitely, that tracks exactly the language of MRE 311 is consistent with what the Supreme Court articulated in Franks.
From the government's, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. One quick question. If we decide he waived it, that's it, right? We don't have to get to the other issue.
Well, I'm not sure. I actually think that this court does need to decide whether or not there was probable cause and whether the good faith exception applies because those were proper. The question of whether or not there was probable cause in the first place was properly raised, and the military judge did issue a decision on it, and the CCA addressed that as well, albeit, as we're arguing, incorrectly, because they considered factors that should have been considered waived. But we do believe that this court does need to address whether there was probable cause and whether the good faith exception applies.
I look forward to getting into probable cause in a second. I'm just wondering, though, is there any indication in the record, and I can ask appellant as well, that would indicate that the military judge was viewing this as a Franks hearing? Here he did excise a statement, which seems to only be permissible in the context of a Franks hearing. Is there anything else in here that indicates that, despite the fact that it was a suppression hearing, that the military judge was operating under the assumption or under the rules of a Franks hearing?
No, in fact, the record would suggest the opposite, because the military judge said that the government had the burden on the motion, and that would not have been the case if this was an actual Franks hearing. The accused has two burdens with respect to Franks or 311D4B, and that's the substantial preliminary showing even to get to the hearing, and then the preponderance. And the military judge didn't mention anything about either of those standards and put the burden on the government. So I think it's very safe for this court to conclude that the military judge was not in any way conducting a Franks hearing in accordance with MRE 311.
Now, in terms of the probable cause issue, I'm wrestling with an issue here. I'd like you to give me some guidance.
Yes, Your Honor.
So we have the military working dog alert on appellant.
Yes.
And there seems to be agreement in the record that military working dog does not have the ability or is not trained to detect cocaine metabolite or THC that is in the bloodstream of a suspect. In other words, if it's being excreted through sweat, the military working dog doesn't have the ability to detect that. So presumably, the military working dog was alerting based on drug residue or drugs themselves on the clothing or on the skin of the appellant here. Search was conducted. No drugs were found. So why is it that if there's no ability of the working dog to detect drugs inside the appellant, that somehow the urine from inside the appellant, there's probable cause to seize that? What's the nexus?
Well, Your Honor, we have to consider the totality of the circumstances in this case and the other facts that were present. We know that the military working dog has the ability to detect residue, which suggests that at some point this individual had illegal contraband, illegal drugs on their person. But then we couple that with the smell of marijuana in the dorms. And so the smell of marijuana, which was detected by somebody who had a controlled burn, who had been certified in controlled burn, so this is burning marijuana, that allows the inference that someone had been using in the dorms recently. And here we have a resident of the dorms who we know moved in at some time after the smell of marijuana, or rather, marijuana was certainly smelled on multiple occasions after he had moved into the dorms.
And before.
Your Honor. According to one witness, which, again, that was not very well developed on the record, and so we believe that the court should not be considering that because the issue was waived under Franks. But certainly this marijuana smell occurred after Appellee had moved into the dorms. And so then we have the dog saying, hey, there's drug residue on this guy. Somebody has been smoking. And, oh, yeah, this guy is somebody who has a previous drug conviction. The affidavit said he was back in the dorms just for out processing after his prior drug offense. So here's somebody who's had access to illegal drugs before, has used them before, and
on that point, what was his conviction for when you said had used them before? There's reference to him being involved in a drug ring, which sounds to me more like distribution. Where in the record is there an indication that he had tested positive for drugs before or had been convicted of use of drugs before?
So he was convicted of use of cocaine and also distribution of cocaine, and introducing cocaine onto a military installation. He did not have a conviction for marijuana, but that's not dispositive because courts have said that you can look at the general type of crime. It doesn't necessarily have to be exactly the same crime. So the fact
we go through all this rigmarole, the dog alerts. We say, well, there's probable cause to search for him to urinate, and then he pops for cocaine. No marijuana anywhere near.
Your Honor, if I can say, Florida v. Harris, the Supreme Court, which was a case talking about drug-sniffing dogs, it said that what is ultimately found is not dispositive or really even relevant to whether or not there was probable cause at the time of the search. Now, it does indicate retroactively that Yeager's alert to Apelli may indeed have been correct because it makes sense. Maybe he had cocaine on his person or the residue of cocaine on his person, and the dog was able to smell that. So, I mean, the results certainly do not suggest somehow that Yeager's alert was inaccurate. But again, when we're looking at probable cause, we have to look at what the probable cause was at the time. The Supreme Court specifically says we don't look at to what the results of the search were.
Under these same circumstances, could the commander have compelled the accused to have blood drawn and blood analyzed for the presence of tetrahydrocannabinol? I see you're going to think about this, but what would be the difference in having blood drawn and providing urinalysis? We're talking about bodily fluids. We're talking about, according to the government, enough probable cause. So what would be the difference?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, I think it depends, and I don't know. I'm much more familiar with the ability of drug tests or urine tests, urinalyses, to be able to detect drugs in the system. But assuming you could take blood, the blood would show that. Yes, and I think it's the same thing. I think you would still have probable cause, assuming that the blood draw would be able to detect recently used THC or whatnot. Yes, then I think that you would similarly have probable cause for that.
And just to be clear, counsel, is it the government's position? I guess you haven't answered this question. Is it the government's position that indication that a service member has been in contact with drugs establishes just on its own probable cause to order a urine analysis?
So just the fact that they may have drug residue on them or that they used before, Your Honor?
This is just the evidence that the dog alerts, right? So that tells us what it tells us. Is that sufficient to establish probable cause to get a search authorization for your analysis?
So, Your Honor, that is a hotly contested debate even within our office. I think it's a much harder case than when we have the smell of marijuana that says, hey, someone was ingesting this substance. But it's difficult to say because in every circumstance, there are going to be other facts that have to be considered. So it's a much harder case if all we have is the dog alert, but I'd be reticent to say never, 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 because I don't want that to come back and bite me if there are other, situations out there where, there are other facts and circumstances that might support probable cause. And like I said, even this is hotly debated. And if in my remaining minutes, I think that helps us roll into a discussion of the good faith exception here, because even
before you get there.
Yes, Your Honor.
I noted that when you went through the different factors that you feel support probable cause, that you didn't cite something that was cited by trial counsel, and I believe is in your brief, this idea of drug dog alerted, we search him, we find no drugs, therefore he must have used those drugs, he must have consumed them. That's a curious proposition to me. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that is a fair. It's an inference that you can draw, and the government does not have to exclude every single innocent possibility of what happened. But it certainly does not negate probable cause to find to search the individual and find that there are no drugs on them, because it does support an inference that that the reason they're not on there, they're not on him, is because he already used them. And
but
so
isn't it a situation where it's a heads I win, tails you lose? If you found drugs on him, then you'd say, well, we found drugs on him, he must also have used them.
Well, I think, Your Honor, either way, I mean, that's just how it is. Either way, either scenario could support probable cause in this case, and certainly doesn't diminish probable cause. So it doesn't have to be one or the other. It could be that both allow inferences that still support probable cause. And I think that that's what there is here. We don't have to choose one or the other.
So finding the drug supports probable cause, not finding the drug supports probable cause.
And why not, Your Honor? It doesn't negate that there is probable cause. Sometimes that's just how the fact. Sometimes that's just how the facts play out. But certainly does allow you to draw an inference that he doesn't have drugs on them because he already consumed them. So maybe if
why
we look
isn't
at
it just that he's a drug dealer?
Well, Your Honor,
so
because
because
we have the smell of marijuana in there, and yes, he could possibly it could possibly be that. Innocent conduct in the sense that, well, he's only a drug user and he didn't actually use. But again, as this court has even said recently, the government doesn't have to exclude every possible innocent explanation. If it is a reasonable probability, if there's a substantial chance that the reason all these facts came into being is because the accused actually did ingest the marijuana, then there's probable cause. And I'm sorry, Chief Justice Stuckey, I had intended to save 4 minutes for rebuttal, and my time is up. So.
Okay. You were granted 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. And
you'd have the opportunity to address the good faith exception. I didn't want to preclude you from doing
that. Okay, thank you. I will do that on rebuttal if there are no further questions at this time.
Can I ask a question? And only because by the time you get back to rebuttal, I will have forgotten my question. But
yes, Your Honor.
Is it fair to characterize the government's position that evidence of contact with a contraband substance, ergo, is evidence of use?
Your Honor, it certainly supports that there was use. It certainly is part of the totality of the circumstances. If someone has residue of illegal contraband on them, and then you couple that with a smell in the dormitory that suggests that someone has just used and smoked and ingested marijuana, then a residue found of drugs on a particular person, that certainly supports probable cause that if you test that person's urine, it is going to show up as being positive for the drugs.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for Hernandez.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Jenna Arroyo, and along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Todd Faneth, we represent the appellee, Airman Basic Robert Hernandez. Probable cause did not exist for the seizure and search of my client's urine for the presence of drugs. Investigator AM drafted his affidavit with reckless disregard for the truth, and in such a way that it would mislead the military magistrate into granting a search authorization. And that is exactly...
Could you speak up a little?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thanks.
And that is exactly what happened in this case. The military magistrate granted a search authorization for my client's urine. Because probable cause did not exist, and because investigator AM drafted his affidavit with reckless disregard for the truth, the good faith exception does not save this search authorization.
Why don't we begin with Major Arroyo, the threshold question raised by the government on waiver. And I know you do respond in your brief, but can you kind of capsulize it as to why you don't think defense counsel waived the issue of falsely included information or reckless omissions?
Yes, Your Honor. With regards to the waiver rule, the purpose is to enable the government to respond and the military judge to make findings and to rule on the issue. And here, there was a particularized objection. Specifically, within the motion, the defense counsel raised specific issues with regards to probable cause and brought up information that had been omitted as well as a factual dispute regarding Yeager's alerts to the door.
My understanding is that, and I'm not criticizing the defense counsel for this at all, but correct me if I'm wrong, the issue of reckless omissions was not raised in the written motion, but it came up during the argument on the motion. Is that what happened?
Yes, Your Honor. And looking at this court's decisions in both United States v. Blackburn and United States v. Bavender, this court has held that you look at the totality of the defense counsel's arguments, both during the motion and during the motion's argument. And so while she did not specifically raise the issue regarding the date and some other issues she raised during her motion's argument, she did raise in the motion that the military working dog AFI prohibits dogs from searching individuals, and also she indicated that a dog cannot alert to the presence of a substance in a person's body, neither of which was included in the affidavit. So she raised those omissions specifically in her motion and then developed them further during the motion's argument. She further developed the omission of the date during Senior Airman AC's testimony and specifically argued it during her argument.
The date you're talking about, when he moved in and when there was a smell of
marijuana? Yes, Your Honor, with regards to the 2 March date, which was predating when he arrived on 9 March in the dorms. She specifically raised that during Senior Airman AC's testimony. It's specifically in his records, which he presented to the military judge, and she specifically argued it throughout her entire argument when she discussed the fact that this omission made the inference that it started right after he moved in just not true. And then she went in to talk about how this was an extremely misleading affidavit based on those facts.
Okay.
Now, specifically, she also developed other issues with regards to the false assertion in her motion and then also during the actual testimony at trial. When the military judge spoke to Staff Sergeant P.O., the dog handler, it was developed that no alerts ever occurred to the door. And when the dog handler was asked by the judge, "Are you certain?" he said, "I'm certain, Your Honor." And his records reflected that no alerts had actually happened to the door. Now, during her argument, defense counsel indicated that we needed to give deference to the dog handler, and then she further stated that Staff Sergeant P.O. was never consulted, and that if he would have been consulted, maybe the affidavit would have been drafted differently, and that because he wasn't, there was misleading information in the affidavit.
The dog handler himself. You're talking about the dog handler?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. He was not consulted.
He was not consulted. He was not consulted prior to the drafting of the affidavit. He indicated on the stand that he was not consulted until about a couple weeks after the affidavit occurred. And so looking at the totality of the arguments that the defense counsel made, she argued throughout her argument that information was left out of the affidavit, that it was absent from the affidavit, that it was not put in the affidavit, that Investigator AM left out a lot of important facts. She said that these omissions were concerning, that it made the affidavit extremely misleading, that it was not a fair picture of what had occurred. All of these things put both the government and the military judge on notice that she was asserting that Investigator AM had acted with reckless disregard for the truth. And the military judge specifically addressed the assertion when he cited this court's holding in United States v. Cowgill, discussing what to do with erroneous information in the affidavit, and he specifically excised that information from his probable cause determination. So he was aware of the erroneous information, and then he failed to make any findings of fact regarding the omissions, which we have argued is clearly erroneous.
All right, well, let me ask you this. Moving past the waiver issue and into the substantive probable cause issue, assuming we agree with you, once you've excised all of the misleading in your information, and you've included what has been, again, from your point of view, recklessly omitted, what does the affidavit look like? What information is before the magistrate from your point of view?
At that point, so if we have excised the information that's incorrect and added in the important information about the date, specifically the magistrate would have been told that there was a smell of marijuana that occurred prior to my client moving in, as well as after he was in the dorms, that he would have been told that there were 2 alerts to my client, specifically to his person. He would have been told that he was searched, both his person as well as his book bag, as well as his room, with nothing being found, no drugs or drug paraphernalia. He was also told that there was no evidence or anything that had suggested that my client was acting evasive or acting like he was under the influence of any substances. He would have then been told that there was also a drug conviction without any further information. And so if you look at that, the Air Force Court said with regards to the drug conviction that the failure to take evidence under oath when it's feasible can be fatal to a finding of probable cause in close calls. And they did not give deference to his knowledge because he failed to ask any additional questions and instead had a mistaken belief about what my client had used. Also, it was over a year.
Sorry, could you report that? Repeat that? He was under a mistaken impression in terms of your what?
With regards to the marijuana. He was under the mistaken belief that my client had used marijuana and cocaine, when in fact my client had not used marijuana. And so when he was.
But he had used cocaine.
He had used cocaine.
And that was part of the drug conviction.
Yes, Your Honor. A drug conviction that the Air Force Court noted had occurred the use over a year prior. And so when they looked at this, the Air Force Court, in looking at the substantial basis, they found that that would have been negligible support for any type of finding of probable cause, use of a drug over a year prior. And so looking at the totality, we have the marijuana smell predating as well as coming after. We have the alerts, which, again, Your Honor, if it's not waived, then those alerts are suspect. They are misleading because Yeager has never been trained to alert to a person. And he's specifically prohibited from actually searching a person. Specifically, it says in their AFI they will not search a person. So therefore, his alerts really don't provide any information. And even if they did, what they would provide was probable cause to search my client's person, not to seize his urine. And again,
you've taken specific issue with how the government has characterized its position, or maybe I characterized it for you when I asked Ms. Payne, that the notion that previous contact with the contraband is evidence of use.
Yes, Your Honor, and the Air Force.
Put it this way: is probable cause that a person has used?
Yes, Your Honor. Contact on it in and of itself is not enough. And again, when looking at what they had, they searched him. They searched his person. They searched his backpack. They searched his room, and nothing happened. Nothing came up. And so then to make the inference that therefore he had used is just to take the residue that was on or about his person a step too far. There was no...
You're taking issue with even that, though, aren't you? The whole notion that the Yeager, the dog, is that how you say his name?
Yes, Your Honor.
That young Yeager detected residue on... You're taking issue with even that, aren't you?
Your Honor...
You're saying that he's not trained to even do that.
He is trained to detect residue, but the important thing is looking at a drug dog and why we are able to use it for probable cause is their proven capability and demonstrated reliability, and of which he has neither in this case because he's specifically not trained to alert on a person. Now, specifically, Staff Sergeant P.O. said, we don't train with this, and, in fact, this is the only time I've ever seen a dog do this, and I've had 3 drug dogs. So that shows the sheer unusualness of this alert, and therefore it should not be considered reliable because there is no proven capability and demonstrated reliability to suggest. And, Your Honor, even if there was, as I did argue just a moment ago, it would have been for probable cause to search his person, not to search his urine.
Now, one point I don't think you touched upon, and I'd like to discuss it a little bit with you, is the fact that not only did the military working dog, I'm not on a first-name basis with Yeager, like you, alert on appellant, but he did not alert on anyone else. What should we think of that?
Your Honor, I think it should be taken in the context of the totality of what was known by the investigator AM as well as what was known by the military magistrate. The entire dorm is a 3-story dorm, and not every single person was searched. So not every single room was searched. So the fact that it alerted on him would potentially suggest to us that he had, because he was searched, maybe residue on or about his person. And as the Air Force Court noted, that in and of itself, there are many reasons why he could have had the residue on or about his person that does not suggest use. And the Air Force Court gave about 5 different reasons why. One is which maybe he had handled it recently. Maybe he used to have drugs in his pocket at some point, or he had handled it on his person. Maybe he was having it and he did not actually use it. And as you noted, Your Honor, maybe he was distributing it. Any which of those which not have provided probable cause to search his urine.
But if you've got, I want to focus more on this issue of the fact that the military working dog did not alert on anyone else. If you've got the smell of marijuana in the dorms, and particularly on that particular floor, I believe the phrase that was used by the investigators is, it was saturated with the smell of marijuana. And the military working dog alerts on one person and one person only. Isn't that something that the government can point to say, hey, this is a pretty good indication of probable cause, a building block for a probable cause determination?
Your Honor, yeah, you're alerted to the second floor and to the third floor. So suggesting that the smell of marijuana was pervasive throughout at least two hallways, Airman D, the person who had smelled the marijuana on the 2nd in March, she was a third floor resident. So suggesting that this smell had been pervasive throughout the entire building. So the fact that he alerted just to one person, and again, we know that not everybody is searched, does not give them probable cause to get into his urine. Again, looking at that, that would have, as I noted, probably have given probable cause, if it did, the alerts themselves, which are suspect, to believe that he might have had it on his person. And at that point, once they search him, probable cause is extinguished. Your Honor, you had noted, well, should we be able to use this lack of any findings to be able to then infer probable cause? And as you noted, that is not a fair inference, that it should not be used to give probable cause. If there was something on him, then they likely would have had probable cause, or in his room. But nothing is alerted to in his room. And we know Jaeger can alert to residual odors. There is no residual odor in his room. So the fact that marijuana is in the hallway is not even in his room enough to cause an alert by a dog. So then to try and use the fact that marijuana is in the hallway with the alerts to get into a search of his urine, that just doesn't give us a nexus to be able to say that there should be probable cause to search his urine. And again, this is different than just searching his person. This is breaching his bodily integrity to then take his bodily fluids.
Just as a factual matter, and forgive me, but am I remembering wrong, or did you say earlier that there had been an alert that Jaeger, the dog that I'm familiar with now, had alerted on at least one other room?
No, Your Honor, I apologize. He alerted to the second floor hallway and the third floor hallway. And Airman D was a resident of the third floor hallway. So I was indicating that that smell had been pervasive throughout the hallways, not just specifically on his floor.
I get you. Okay, thank you.
Now, with regards to good faith, there is no probable cause to search my client's urine. And then looking at this, the fact that Investigator AM had drafted his affidavit with reckless disregard for the truth, that would preclude a finding of good faith on behalf of the investigator. He excluded information that was pertinent to a probable cause determination, and we know this because when we look at the military magistrate, two of the three things that he found important actually were false. He thought it was important that the dog had alerted on the door, which was not true, was inaccurate, and two, he thought it was very important that the smell of marijuana began the day after my client moved in, which again was shown to be false. So when we look at his totality of the circumstances and what he was actually using in a probable cause determination, two of those three things were false. And so therefore, Investigator AM's reckless disregard for the truth in drafting this affidavit would cause the good faith exception to not apply to the search authorization, and therefore it should have not been used to seize his urine, nor should any of the results of it been used to find him guilty of a crime. Specifically with some of the other things regarding reckless disregard for the truth, specifically the circumstantial evidence that was present does show by preponderance of the evidence that Investigator AM did draft his affidavit with reckless disregard for the truth. Specifically, when we look at the assertion, I would ask this court to look at United States v. Brown, a Third Circuit case that the government cited to in their brief. And in that case, they looked at an information that was provided in an affidavit that was false, and they said that you don't indicate something in an affidavit unless you have a sufficient grounding to believe that. And in this case, that the person who drafted the affidavit did not have sufficient grounding. And while the government might argue that Investigator AM was present and that he relied on a recollection, we know this recollection did not happen because the alerts did not happen. And Staff Sergeant P.O. directly contradicted that those alerts happened because he testified, no, Your Honor, no alerts happened, and his records demonstrated that they didn't. The failure to even reach out to Staff Sergeant P.O., the one who had sufficient grounding, shows, and as the court in Brown held, would have demonstrated reckless disregard for the truth. Now, with regards to the omitted information, looking at it, it was very important to note that it predated his arrival. Because, as the Air Force Court noted, when we look at the information that had been provided, this information suggested it only started after he came in. So a reasonable inference from that would be he's the one smoking marijuana. But the Air Force Court said, but that's not true, because we know that it predated his arrival. And we know that because Airman D told Senior Airman AC that she'd smelled it on the second. This information he wrote down directly after talking to her in his notes. And those notes were provided to the military judge. Now, to not include that information is information that a reasonable person would know is something that a judge would like to know.
Counsel, what is the standard? Well, how do we distinguish between reckless disregard for the truth and just sort of run-of-the-mill negligence?
So, Your Honor, in general, the courts have, I guess, struggled with that, and that's why they've come up with a couple of different terms. And so when you look at this court as well as what the circuit courts have said, they potentially use different definitions for material omissions as well as material or false assertions. So specifically, false assertions usually are looked at in terms of whether there was serious doubt regarding the veracity of the information, or whether there was obvious reasons to doubt the veracity of that information. With regards to omissions, this court in Cowgill actually used the standard that the Third Circuit in Wilson v. Russo discussed with regards to withholding of information that any judge or that any reasonable person would know a judge would like to know. And in Cowgill, this court actually looked at it from the terms of a detective had talked to a judge who had asked a question about an informant's like reliability and corroboration. And in that case, they said, well, not only was it a fact that he would have wanted to know, or a fact that he would have wanted to know, the judge specifically wanted to know that information. And so the withholding is something the Third Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, and again, this court in Cowgill, as well as in Blackbird, recently discussed as being a definition of reckless disregard. And so the Air Force Court did specifically look at that definition. However, I would also argue that there was obvious reasons to be concerned about the veracity of this information when he didn't have any information to support that there were three alerts to the door, as well as the fact that he had reasons to doubt that my client was smoking marijuana when it predated his arrival. And so those things should have been put in. He also had doubts about the alerts by the dog, because Staff Sergeant Pio had indicated that this was unusual, that this was not normal, and that, again, that the dog doesn't typically alert to a person. So these are, again, serious doubts or obvious reasons to doubt the veracity of the allegations that he was putting forward to the military magistrate. And looking at some of the other things that were omitted from this affidavit, the length of the time that a residual can actually remain on a person's clothing or in their skin was also not mentioned. Staff Sergeant Pio indicated it could be weeks up to a month. And that's something that military magistrate was not told. So he was not aware that even if there was this residue on my client, how long could it remain? Well, if it's up to a month, the likelihood and fair probability they're going to find, again, evidence of drug use in his body is very, very slim at that point. That was not provided, nor was the fact that the military working dog AFI prohibits dogs from searching a person. Now, the last thing that was not provided, again, was the unusualness of this alert, which, again, suggests that this alert would not have been reliable. And, Your Honor, I see I'm out of time, so any further questions?
Thank you, Counsel. I interject that I don't want to think about your clients running around for a month with residue on him, but that's neither here nor there.
Yes, Your Honor.
Rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. There are quite a few things I hope I have time to get through. Number one, we are asking this court to use this case as an opportunity to remind trial practitioners of how to use MRE 311D4B. That's going to be better for the accused who can better build a case if there is one. It's better for the government to be able to rebut that case if there is one. It's just going to be better for the military justice system overall if this court emphasizes the correct way to raise these issues to make sure they're preserved on appeal. Appellee's counsel talked a lot about recklessness, and I think this is an important place to point out that AFCA had a mandate in this case to consider the evidence in the light most favorable to the government. And on this very sparse record, when there could have been any number of reasonable or nearly negligent reasons why the investigators didn't take certain steps or didn't include or did include certain things in the affidavit. It was just wrong for AFCA to consider. They considered the evidence in the light least favorable to the government when they jumped to a conclusion of recklessness. And so even if the issue wasn't waived, they certainly should have considered that there were possibly reasonable or merely negligent explanations that did not meet the Frank standard. As far as jumping back to probable cause, I think the one thing that appellee's counsel failed to mention is Sergeant Olmos' testimony about how confident he was that this was a positive alert. And the magistrate's understanding that the drug dog was not, they are detected not specifically to search people, but they're going to detect to an odor wherever the odor is. And so if it happens to be on a person, that can still be a positive alert. And Your Honors, if we look to the Supreme Court decision in Florida v. Harris, at page 246 of that decision, the Supreme Court acknowledges that drug dogs have the capability to detect residue of drugs on residual odors on people. And so given the Supreme Court's acknowledgement of that, there's no reason here to consider that Yeager's alert on appellee was somehow unreliable. So it is completely appropriate to consider it as part of the totality of the circumstances. I would also like this court to keep in mind the deference that is afforded to magistrates in making their decisions. And if this was a close call, it should have been resolved in favor of the fact that there was a warrant obtained in this case. Now, moving on to the good faith exception. The good faith exception in this case, we have argued that any issue with regard to recklessness was waived. And even if it wasn't, the military judge made a finding of fact that is supported by the record, that there was no evidence presented of reckless disregard for the truth or falsities in the affidavit. And certainly there's nothing that anyone can point to say that that finding of fact was clearly erroneous. So then what we're left with is really whether the prong of Leon that says whether the affidavit was so lacking in indicia of probable cause that belief in its existence would be entirely unreasonable. And I think the Eighth Circuit case in Carpenter, which we cited in our reply brief, is very instructive on that, because Eighth Circuit said entirely unreasonable is strong language. It's not language that is often used by the Supreme Court, and there's no reason for us to water it down. And so in Carpenter, the Eighth Circuit looked to the fact that we had several levels of magistrate judges, et cetera, who found probable cause in this case. We had the district court that found probable cause in this case. So how can we say that the officer's reliance on this warrant was completely unreasonable? And that's the situation here. We had a military judge who evaluated the facts of this case and found probable cause. And so that's at least some indication to this court that the reliance, even if this court finds this to be a close call, even if this court were to find that there's not probable cause, I think that is a very good indication that the agent's reliance on this warrant or the search authorization was not entirely unreasonable. And if it was not entirely unreasonable, the good faith exception should apply. Now, the last thing I want to mention is the balancing test that comes with Rule 311, or MRE 311. And I think in this case it would be very incongruent to conclude that Investigator AM's conduct was so sufficiently deliberate that it needs to be deterred when trial defense counsel got up in trial and refused to say that it was improper conduct. I mean, what is there to deter here? At most, merely negligence, and the Supreme Court has said that that is not enough to apply the exclusionary rule. And in Leon, in fact, the Supreme Court said, indiscriminate application of the exclusionary rule may well generate disrespect for law and the administration of justice. And here, when we have a situation where AFCA overturned a conviction, excluded evidence, and I'm sorry, Judge Stickey, I see my time's up. May I just finish my thought?
Go ahead.
If we have a situation where police officers or evidence is excluded or convictions are overturned, when Investigator AM never got a chance to get up on the stand and explain why he omitted certain information or why he included some information, that is more likely to engender distrust of the courts rather than to have any important deterrent effect. Thank you, Your Honor. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. The case is now submitted.
Chief Judge, as a point of personal privilege, could I just note for the record and for the assembled people here that unless we have some type of emergency proceeding in the coming months, this is your last day as Chief Judge and as an active judge of the court. Now, we are looking forward very much to a portrait unveiling in the coming months, and at that time we will be making far more extensive remarks than I'm making right now. But I think it's important and appropriate to mark this very important occasion in your life and in the history of this court. You have an extremely distinguished record of public service throughout your professional life, as well as an extremely distinguished record here in the court. It's been a privilege to know you, to work with you, to have your friendship. You've been a wonderful colleague and a brilliant jurist. We very much look forward to having you serve as a senior judge on the court in the future. Maybe you don't look forward to that. We shall see. But I just want to, on behalf of the judges and on behalf of the public, thank you for your public service.
Thank you, Kevin. You can look forward to having Kevin as the chief judge. He will do a superb job. His detail orientation, his attention to the record, his intellectual suppleness, you need not fear. It's going to be a great ride with Kevin in the center chair. This is my last day. I thank Kevin for the sentiments expressed. I have a sense of doors closing. This morning I got the intelligence that my old mentor, Senator John Warner, had died last night. One of the great gentlemen of the Senate, somebody we really could use now. But so be it. In any event, thank you all. Thank you all retroactively for your expressions of sympathy last fall on the death of my wife. It has been a great privilege of my life to serve on this court and to know the people here and to do the work of this court. And I bid you all a fond farewell until the fall when we will talk about this at greater length. Court is in recess pending further order of the court.